Welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjees. I'm Svetlana.
And I'm Ben.
In season 2, we will be traveling around the globe, out of Switzerland, and bring amazing leaders from businesses, thought leaders, political leaders, of course, investors and experts.
We're working at implementing and realizing all the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, better known as SDGs.
And they are also making profit.
Hello, I am Amina Gurifakim, and I'm the sixth president of the Republic of Mauritius.
My name is Parvati, and I'm a musical artist and the founder and CEO of Parvati Foundation.
I'm Michael Bichbichai. I'm an entrepreneur here in Bichbichai. I'm running on one side of a financial services company.
You know, hundreds of deals a month, we are seeing more things happening in this impact world. And this is because, look, the world is changing.
So join us to discover impact investing ecosystem.
See you every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Central European time at Swiss Impact with Banerjees.
See you on Friday. Act with impact.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone. And to our viewers for Far East, good night.
Welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjees.
Today we start with the sad news. As many of you must have heard, His Royal Highness Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, passed away today morning. So it's a great loss because he cared about the environment and he cared about the humanity. And he contributed and worked for both. Svetlana, I propose that we dedicate our show today to him.
Absolutely, I agree. And of course, our deepest condolences to the family and all royal family members. However, we need to welcome you to our season 2. And this is a good news, as we've been with you since 3 months now. And, you know, we were broadcasted in 122 countries through many different channels. And I hope you watched one or two at least of our episodes, and now also aware about impact investing.
So in this program, we talk to global leaders, policymakers, experts, academics on the topic of impact investment and impactful businesses. Moreover, we get into the action to convert the unconverted, to transform them, to journey to unsustainable to sustainable companies. We take actions and we incorporate SDGs in their business to generate positive results.
And as you see, we are traveling around the world in different countries out of Switzerland. Today, we will be in New York with United Nations. But before we invite our speaker, Ben, please tell us a nice story of today, as you are famous for your stories.
So today I want to talk about United Nations. In my personal opinion, it's the only transnational organization that exists today which can create global movements and initiatives. So and it signs agreements, and one of such agreements which was signed was the Paris Agreement in 2016, which was signed under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, also shortly known as UNFCCC.
Right, and in my opinion, you know, we have two options left. Either the governments, businesses, and financial institutions must adapt fast, voluntarily, and in scientifically proven ways to implement the Paris Agreement, or it should be done by force. For the sake of humanity, our planet, and all life on it.
Exactly. That's my point. That's exactly my point. If you come to this, I mean, maybe it sounds a bit radical, but...
A little bit? I think it's very radical.
For example, the Amazon forest. Maybe it's a time that we should consider taking Amazon forest away from countries like Brazil and putting it under the protection of the United Nations, or making the Arctic exploitation free, or stopping the Chinese fishing fleets from causing global destruction of biodiversity and protecting the marine life all around the world.
Absolutely. You know, slowly we are running out of time to talk, to negotiate, and now we need to act. many of you know that I'm an action-oriented person, and it's all for the sake of the coming generations.
Yeah, and it's today I was in the afternoon in a meeting, a global meeting on climate change, and one of the things very shocking I learned is that apparently in 1992 there was a global climate change treaty signed to cut down the emission, but since then the only thing that has happened is that the emission has increased. So anyway, let's go on the lighter side. So Svetlana, can you at least tell for the newcomers of the new viewers, what do we mean by impact investment, and what is the course that we give to educate people?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start with the basics again. So impact investments are investment into innovative enterprises which create social, environmental impact, of course, positive one, beside financial return. And this impact can be measured. So this is why the definition sounds simple, but it's not always so obvious to incorporate impact into business strategies. So this is why we started our training program for entrepreneurs and startups, where we answer such questions like how to create successful and meaningful business solving both social and environmental issues while generating high returns, or how to structure and to scale your business to generate both high returns and impact. Again, how to fundraise successfully in impact investing sector, how to get support, financial, but also expertise for your impactful business. So we will be running this course over and over again now, because people seem to need it in various countries. So just keep an eye on kamoma.ch or at impactinvestingschool.com, where we will publish the next course date.
So today, our guest is a speaker. I know her quite long. She's a scientist, she's an idealist, speaker, an international negotiator, and an expert in true sense on environment and economy.
Yes, and Dr. Jameson Erwin, she has worked at the intersection of nature development since 1990. She currently works at United Nations Development Program, focusing on enabling countries to develop a map of hope for nature-dependent goals that puts nature at the heart of sustainable development. She also focuses on supporting local actions on nature-based solutions, including leading UNDP Equator Initiative on supporting governments in identifying nature-based solutions for climate, and on supporting action and ambition on protected areas. The previous work, it is related to the Nature Conservancy, the World Wildlife Fund for Nature, and the Forest Stewardship Council. She holds a PhD in natural resources from the University of Vermont. But let's talk more impact. So let's invite our amazing guest, Dr. Jameson Erwin, and welcome her today at our show.
And just to what today we are going to discuss is who is ENDP, and I think she will be the first one. So Dr. Jameson Erwin, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much, Ben and Svetlana. Thank you.
So I just wanted to ask you, for our global audience, can you please tell us a short about your background and your activities within the UNDP? And can you please tell the audience who are not aware of it, a brief history, activities and mandate of UNDP?
Certainly. Let me start with the United Nations Development Program. So UNDP is the UN's oldest development agency. It was founded in the year of my birth, 1965, so we're both 55 years old. UNDP works in about 170 countries and territories. Our mission is to help eradicate poverty and reduce inequality. Our focus is on helping the world achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. This is a set of ambitious goals and targets that were adopted by all of the world's governments. And within these goals, UNDP's focus is specifically on six areas: lifting and keeping people out of extreme poverty, fostering peaceful, just, and inclusive societies, preventing crises and promoting societal resilience, promoting clean, renewable, and affordable energy, ensuring women's empowerment and gender equality, and then my favorite, working with nature to find solutions to some of our most pressing challenges, including how to tackle our climate crisis. From my own side, Svetlana, you did a great introduction, thank you.
I've spent 30 years working at the intersection of nature, people, and sustainable development. I have a training as both a social scientist and a biodiversity scientist, and it might be a bit of an oxymoron to say a biodiversity scientist is an idealist, but I am. I work for...
Welcome to our club. We are kind of idealists here. So,
indeed, yes. Economists and biodiversity scientists, we are a rare breed to also be idealists. I've also, as you mentioned, worked for a number of environmental groups, but the bulk of my career has been working for UNDP, and for the last 5 years, I've been leading a program called Nature for Development that seeks to put nature right at the heart of sustainable development.
Mm-hmm. This is discussion we are going to have, because today afternoon I had a very depressing meeting with the climate change on this, about nature and development, but we'll come to that. So last time we spoke, you showed me a kind of map of a country.
Yeah.
How you can advise governments or help governments to do projects to protect its biodiversity, support its economy, and also keep aligned to the Paris Agreement. Can you tell a bit more about that project?
This is one of my favorite projects. I've been in this field for 30 years and projects come and go, but I really love this one. It's called the Map of Hope. And our work is helping countries create maps of essential life support areas. I've been fascinated with mapping and geospatial technology for at least 15 years. And I remember when GIS or geographic information software came out, and it was like this big light bulb went off, and then Google Earth came out. And I thought, this is gonna change everything on how we do planning. But the reality of land use planning, and I should know, I spent 7 years on our local planning board, I did my PhD on this topic, is horribly bureaucratic and still in the dark ages. The issue is this, we've produced more data in the last 2 years than we have in all of human history combined.
Wow.
And that rate continues to accelerate. And it's especially true of spatial data, but we're not using it in the way that we could. So about 2 years ago, a couple of us started thinking, what if we could use spatial data to change how governments make decisions. So I'm wondering, can I share my screen and share you a map with you?
Certainly, certainly.
Fabulous. Let me just share it here.
We don't see the screen yet, but we're really eager to see that.
Indeed. Okay. How about now? Can you see this?
Yes. Now it's coming. Something. Yeah. Now it's coming.
Super. Fabulous. So when we think about mapping,
bigger, Jamie,
can you make it a bit bigger?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Great. So when we think about mapping nature, we think about generally things like mapping biodiversity intactness. We think about the human footprint. We think about protected areas and connectivity. This is what mapping usually looks like for biodiversity scientists. But we took this same thinking and said, what if we could map nature for development? What if we could find places to protect, manage, and restore for carbon sequestration, for water security, for disaster risk reduction, for food security, and jobs and livelihoods? What if we flipped the question? And moreover, what if we allowed countries to set their own priorities, their own values, and dial up water and dial up carbon, whatever their values were, and create a single map of hope that said, if we protect, manage, and restore these places in our country, we'll achieve not only the three Rio conventions, but we'll also achieve our nature-dependent sustainable development goals. And I'm so excited to see that this project is happening in 12 countries around the world, and countries are beginning to use this as the basis for development planning.
Mm-hmm. Can our audience find more information about it on some of the websites of UNDP?
Yes, you can go to unbiodiversitylab.org, and we're just about to launch, so we're about a month out of launching. However, they can also reach me directly at jameson.irvin@undp.org, and I'd be happy to share you share with them any information they'd like. They might like.
So that's it. Means it's like how do you say it, when a film comes out first? It's the we got to know about it first on our TV before the whole.
You heard it first. Indeed, you are.
Can I read you some of the conclusions I made today during the meeting? It was with Professor Ekins, Paul Ekins from UCLA. And he has been doing research the last 40 years on climate change and economics. So he says the conclusions he came to, that he said the only way that we can keep the Paris Agreement is, number one, global, it's the most important, is global cooperation. Number two, rapid technological development. Number three, strong environmental policies of governments, national and international governments. Number four, low population growth. Number five, declining inequality. Number six, dietary shift. We have to move slowly away and away from meat. And number seven is forest protection. He says if these are not, and he said, unfortunately, none of them are being worked at. He said if these are not implemented, there is no way we can get to the Paris Agreement. Well, and he also said it needs unprecedented actions by all countries, especially the big emitters.
So I would agree with those points 100%. And there's something deeper I'd like to go into, which is around forest protection. And the issue is a little bit more nuanced than that. Nature can provide 38%, more than a third, of our climate mitigation solution. And yet it only receives 2% of finance for climate mitigation. Nature is essential for climate adaptation, for water security, for food security, for disaster risk reduction, but it's ignored in policies. Our team reviewed 100 nationally determined contributions. This is what countries say they'll do about climate. And we found that nature-based solutions are just this under-invested, under-explored avenue of climate. So including forest protection, we need to think about mangroves and peatlands. We need to think about keeping intact forests intact. When you think about the Amazon in general, it's slowly converting into a system that's now releasing carbon dioxide as opposed to sequestering it.
Exactly. That was also one of the points.
This is interconnectedness. You know, it's usually we come always to this point at least once in a show, you know, that we are interconnected with nature. You know, we lost the connection, but we need to gain it back as humans. Without the nature, we just can't survive. That's pretty obvious for many people, but for many still not. So. Jane, let me ask you another question, which is related to some contradictory facts. So the vision of UNDP is to remove hunger, protect the planet, and bring peace and prosperity. At this moment, to a normal layman, this seems to have become self-contradictory. For example, as China brought up hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, it seems to have brought in global scale destruction, from increase in carbon emissions to violent destruction of nature and environment around the world. And looking at the present situation, are these visions at all compatible? Or like, how can we achieve one without destroying something around? So what do you think about that?
It's a really great question, Svetlana. And I'd like to just dive a little bit deeper into our four-part planetary emergency as part of my response. So we just touched on the issue of how interdependent these elements are. We think of our four-part planetary emergency. The first is our nature crisis, and this is largely invisible to the world. The recent studies on biodiversity all point to the same conclusion. We're facing a precipitous decline in my lifetime, by the time I'm 80. So we're headed for the extinction of more than a million species within the next 30 years. We're already seeing these major tipping points in nature, from the collapse of the Great Barrier Reef in Australia to the fires in the Amazon in Australia and Siberia. We've already wiped out more than 80% of all wild mammals. So we're really truly witnessing this unraveling of our global life support system. When we think of climate crisis, no reasonably literate scientist on Earth can deny that we're experiencing climate change. And we're seeing this on every pocket in the planet. So just this morning, I already saw some birds that arrived that we have not seen this early ever before. And the cherry blossom season in Japan is 1,200 years, broke a 1,200-year record. So it's the interaction, though, between biodiversity loss and climate change that's really potent. We're thinking of the World Economic Forum report that shows drought, famine, and disaster, et cetera. So your question is this incompatible? When we think of our inequality crisis and our health crisis, the answer is it can't be incompatible. We must find another way. If we continue on this trajectory, we don't really have a guaranteed survival as a species. And the model of One Health or planetary health, of looking at the health of our societies and our planet as part of a single integrated system, really is the way forward. And this means repositioning the health of the natural world, not as something that's expendable, but as something that's an essential foundation for human health.
Right, But I mean, when you name these numbers, it's awful, you know, this 80% of biodiversity. And people know it's there, but still this human ignorance, somehow they're not acting. So how would you then put people into action? Or how do you put people into action around you? You know, because you always need to start with yourself, then your circle, and then action will spread. So how would you activate?
And Jamie's in UN, so the whole world is listening to you.
Well, one of the fallacies is that this depends on individual behavior. And let me tell you what I mean. You think of an analogy of an iceberg, and you're in a single rowboat, and you're rowing your heart out, and you think, all right, this huge iceberg, I see it, I'm going to move it myself. And you start rowing it, and you think, well, it's not moving anywhere, it's moving away from me. And then you start to realize, okay, 90% of it is below the surface, and you bring 9 more friends. You think, all right, you know, if I just row harder and faster with more people, I can move it. And then you realize on the other side, there's a power speedboat pulling the opposite way. Okay, now if I get 10 more speedboats, I can finally fix this problem. The issue that we're not talking about is the tide and the current that we don't see. And so this is the whole milieu, the whole economic system. A recent UNDP report called the UN Development Human Development Report found that no country has been able to develop without first having a negative consequence on nature. So our model of development is broken. Our economic system is broken. Our market is broken. So to say to individuals, be sure to recycle your bag when you go to the grocery store, we need profound change that is much more than consumer driven.
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely. Another question to you, Jamie, is about how can we help you, or how can businesses, policymakers, and academics viewing us now around the world, how can they support you with your project?
Well, I shouldn't have ended on a negative note to that last comment.
Now it's too late. It's already broadcast.
which is not to say that individuals don't have power. Individuals have remarkable power. Whether you're in a business or you're a policymaker or you're an academic, I think some of the avenues of change are driven by business leaders, by visionary policymakers. I think of Bhutan and Costa Rica, the two countries that are outsized, that they have an outsized influence on the world because they're both aiming for or have achieved carbon neutrality, even though they're tiny countries. So we think about the transformations that need to occur. We need to think about businesses thinking about their business in a different way. We need to have a whole system of supply chain, a whole system of transparency, a whole value chain about what does it mean to be a good corporate citizen of the world. I think for academics, it's about asking the right questions, the pointed questions, the questions that will drive people to ask, what is the impact of a shrimp farm on the planet? And I think for policymakers, it's about being bold and thinking in terms of intergenerational equity, in terms of where we are at this point in time. Scientists tell us we have about a decade to change the trajectory of human future, which sounds, it is as profound as it sounds. And I think policymakers need to recognize the time that they're in right now. This is unlike any other time in any other part of human history.
Yeah, I completely agree. And what I notice also that, for example, I have a son who is 14 years old, and also the universities, when we are giving courses and teaching at the universities, mainly also in the emerging countries, that in my opinion, you can split them into three parts. One is those where kids or students who are really active, engaging actively, taking part, taking actions, doing something. The second group, which I find unfortunately is a much bigger one, is getting bigger and bigger, is that they're losing hope. They are kind of, doesn't matter whatever we do, we are doomed. Our future is doomed. And the people who can make the difference, they're doing nothing about it. And of course, there is a small third group who are not aware of it, who don't care. They're just enjoying life.
I think it's a small group.
So what would be your advice to these youth, especially to the group one and group two?
You know, I actually have the privilege of serving on the board of a group called Youth for Nature. And I guess they didn't get the memo that, you know, I'm 55. But I absolutely adore this group because of their hope. So I have incredible respect for the youth-driven mission and the movement that we're seeing all around us, the Fridays for Future and the Planetary Crisis Group. When I was 16, you know, and I'm sure the both of you, I didn't get the memo that you could change the world by standing outside of your parliament building with a sign that says you were on a climate strike from school, and that would launch a global movement. I didn't get that memo. You know, I sort of got it in my 50s, and I didn't realize that you could mobilize millions of people and more than 1,000 national and local governments to declare a climate emergency just because you asked them to. So what we've learned from the Greta Thunberg movement are a couple of lessons. First, you don't need to wait until you can vote to act. And voting is not your only act. You can take action right now. And second, you know, youth have a kind of moral authority that people in power or position or authority don't have. It's their future that this generation is squandering, and no one can deny that it's morally acceptable, that it's morally acceptable to do so. Youth are starting to use this moral authority. So I have a couple of points of advice. And the first is, try not to let despair prevent you from taking action. The change is not linear, it's not inevitable, and it's not easy to track and detect the impacts of what you do. There's often a time lag. Change requires patience. Hope is an active verb, not a passive feeling. Second, the people from age, I'd say 12 to 24, use the channels of change that you have available. TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Youth are incredibly savvy, and they can create a platform. I look at these people with awe when they have hundreds of thousands of followers. I think, how can I do that? I'm lucky. I think the third is finding the leverage points that will lead to change. It's fine to boycott a bank that's linked with the financing of climate change, but it's a lot better to write an open letter to the bank's president, share it on Twitter, tag the bank, and get a bunch of friends to like and retweet it. And then finally, you know, don't be afraid to hold adults accountable and the companies they run and the governments they serve in. Hold them accountable. If you see something that you in your heart as a young person feel like it doesn't make sense for the planet or your future, speak out, whether that's an investment in an oil pipeline or a new coal plant, logging of a national park, speak out. Your voice is powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thanks, Jamie. And you know, as I'm teaching quite frequently as a guest lecturer at several Swiss universities, and sometimes not even to finance students. Recently, I've been teaching at Neuchâtel University, sociology students, which have no idea about finance. So now they know what's impact investing as well. But the point is that still, I'm just a guest lecturer. The majority of students, they are not taught about SDGs, about impact investing. You know, it's still a privileged or small group of students who know about it because they are interested themselves, not because university said, okay, guys, you need to learn about it. And as I've been studying at the University of Zurich, finance, banking, finance, nobody talked about impact investing at all. And this is sad that they're still not doing that. So how would you as UN kind of maybe impose SDGs into educational programs and universities around the world, and you might have the power.
Well, it's hard to impose anything as the UN. It's more that we serve the government.
Let's use another word, to advise to implement this or incorporate it to the programs of the university.
You know, I think it starts with government's commitments to the SDGs. And if you take Scotland, for example, it's one of the few countries that's taken the SDGs, fully embraced them, made it their own, and created a whole national framework that uses the SDGs to measure change. They use it to communicate. And so I think when you look at Scotland as a whole, people are very aware of the SDGs. So it's a matter of really infusing within a government that permeates them down to an educational system, that we need to change the system. So many people benefit from our broken economic and financial and market system that nobody really wants to look too closely, but we have to. And the educational system that we have inherited from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, keep in mind that, you know, last 2 years, as I said, of data have eclipsed all of human history. We're just not equipping our educational system to teach students about the changes that need to be made in order to transform our trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Well, cheese to Scotland then.
But the thing that worries me is that today I heard about this treaty that was signed in 1992 by the UN, the Global Climate Change Treaty. Or we are aware of the treaty signed, or the polluter pays. What was the name of the treaty? Polluter pays the
more.
Yeah, it was something
tenfold.
But none. The problem is all these treaties are signed by all these countries and ratified, but somehow things don't change on the ground level. Why do you think this time it would be different? Why do you think that this time in September you will be able to get the countries not just sign the treaty? I mean, they have already signed the Paris Agreement, but really take clear steps, because the last I read about it, none of the countries are following it yet.
It requires a deep think that I don't think anyone has really figured out, of how does change happen. Signing a treaty doesn't mean that change will happen. When we think of the Convention on Biological Diversity, it had these bold, ambitious goals for 2020, and we achieved almost none of them.
Mm-hmm.
However, it did have an impact. We went from something like 7% of protection to now we have hit 17% protection of our world's terrestrial areas. That's an enormous amount in 10 years. And a treaty provides space for change to happen. It doesn't necessarily dictate that change will happen, but it provides the roadmap for where change needs to happen. It requires a fundamental shift in thinking about how the world needs to run. And I see signs of that everywhere. So, for example, the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure or Nature-Related Financial Disclosure is starting to have an impact. The companies are thinking, uh-oh, I might be held accountable for my impact on the climate and on nature. And those are the kind of levers that really do have, they put the screws to the change that the treaties help create space for.
Exactly. And one of my friends is also a scientist, and he was saying that he also wrote an article on that. He said that mankind is sleepwalking into a systemic crisis, which will go together with collapse of societies and also global market failure. So that means for this systemic crisis, you need a systemic solution, which of course, I think UN is maybe the only one which can provide such a solution. So since you are one of the few who have access to all these studies and information, what would be your educated opinion on this?
Yeah, thank you. So the most recent World Economic Forum report that I mentioned on global risks showed that nature and climate are the two biggest risks. But another report that's less cited is one called Nature's Risk Rising, that shows that $44 trillion of economic value generation, half the world's GDP, is either moderately or highly dependent on nature and its services, and therefore at risk. So, you know, roughly half the world's GDP is at risk of nature's loss but we're not really internalizing that. And I would say it's only been in the last 5 years that people are really conscious that loss of nature means the loss of our future, the loss of our resilience, the loss of our economies. And so another review, the Dasgupta review, really came up with four big headlines. It's a 690-page report that you can reduce into, you know, four bullet points. The first is that our economies, our livelihoods, our well-being, our very lives are wholly dependent upon nature. As nature goes, so does our future. The second, we failed to find a model of sustainable development that maintains the health of biodiversity and ecosystems. We haven't found it yet. Third, our current consumption and production patterns are endangering our current and future generations. And then at four, which gets to the heart of your question, is at heart is a set of deep-rooted failures, institutional failures, government failures, governance failures, corporate failures, and market failures. So, you know, I think there in UNDP, we're thinking of six big transformations that need to happen to change where we're headed. The first is eliminate the harmful subsidies. We invest $5.3 trillion every year on fossil fuel subsidies. It's insanity. And almost $1 billion on food subsidies that harm nature. Second trend is divesting investments that harm nature. In this world, it does not make sense to clear cut 200,000 hectares of primary rainforest, put on 200,000 head of cattle, and make a profit, yet it does make business sense. That can't continue. The third is investing in nature. And Ben, I think we've discussed this in the past. There's a missing middle in finance where many investors don't want to get out of bed for under 100 million, but the investments that are needed are in the half a million to 10 million range. So we need to figure out how to break that nut and invest in nature positive, nature friendly investments. A fourth is big, bold goals for protection. And so over 85 governments have agreed to a nature pledge where they want to invest in 30% protection by 2030. Fifth is using nature to tackle climate change. As I mentioned, nature is responsible for 38% of our climate mitigation, but just receives 2% of finance. That's got to change. And then finally, one that I'm really most passionate about is when we think about our planetary safety net requires a big investment in protection, most of those gains have to come on indigenous lands. And that means protecting, safeguarding the rights of indigenous peoples, protecting them from the violence that they're seeing, the unprecedented rise in intimidation and murder. So I think that one of the biggest changes that has to happen is putting indigenous peoples in their territories and safeguarding their right and keeping those lands intact.
Yeah. Jimmy, then I have a challenging question for you. And so to my knowledge, the company Amazon, one of the world's largest companies, as you know, doesn't give any, even 1 cent to Amazon Forest, whose name it uses. So there are quite many similar examples. So are you working together with these large corporations to make them aware of the damage they are causing and advise them to mend the path so they can make a positive difference to the world? As a huge corporation, you can also obviously make a huge impact.
Well, a couple of comments. First of all, I think the Bezos Fund is funding nature. It is trying to make a difference in the world. So I see a trend in these large corporations, the owners, and beginning to acknowledge their role in philanthropy. I see groups like the Vies Foundation, who donated $1 billion to nature. I see companies that are part of Lion's Share, which is companies that agree to use 1% of their advertising spend toward nature. I do see a trend in companies wanting to fund nature. The challenge is that we're talking about a very fast rate of change that's needed, but corporations are slow, not always nimble.
But what I would say is that in case of Bezos, because that's a good example, his foundation may be giving some money to the, but we are talking about the corporation itself. Will the corporation itself slowly also start mend its way? And because, for example, how much products, I'm not aware if there are a lot of products, eco products or eco-friendly products, which you can buy from Amazon. So these are that incorporate SDGs or incorporate nature-friendly processes in these big corporations. Are you involved in communication with these big corporations?
It's not really the mandate of the UN to do that. What we do try and do is champion commitments that corporations have, for example, to deforestation-free commodities. We support them through a green growth platform. It's a question again about how change happens and whether mm-hmm. it's a company that wants to be a leader, such as I think Keurig is one of the big leaders in sustainable fashion and looking at brands that really try and make a difference on sustainable fashion. The UN doesn't really have the mandate to, it has a mandate to convene dialogue. And I think that we are convening dialogue with the private sector, with companies that say, I want to make a change. But there needs to be an evolution away from just corporate social responsibility and away from just becoming a B Corp, actually changing the foundational nature of their business to become a circular economy, become an engine of circular economy as opposed to a linear economy that results in waste.
That's what she teaches to everybody.
Wonderful.
How to incorporate SDGs in the company itself, in the business.
Exactly.
Yeah, because the issue with some of these big corporations, so some of them are bigger than countries. I mean, budget-wise or financial capacity-wise. So they can make a big difference.
Yeah, let's go to my other favorite topics, meat. As you know, I'm a vegan person, and now there are some discussions also in countries like Netherlands, Spain, Germany, New Zealand, and your own country, Canada, as well. They're considering meat tax, which sort of aligns with a comment of your colleague from United Nations chief economist who said, measure the value of nature before it's too late. And I completely agree with that. And actually one of our friends said also that natural asset is the biggest asset in the world to which no asset manager is paying attention to. Mm. So what would you say to that about meat tax? How do you see that? And to the asset managers? No message.
Jamie is thinking, why did I say yes to this?
Well, first of all, thanks for offering me Canadian citizenship. I will accept it. Thank you, Canada. Oh, I'm actually American.
Okay.
This is on your.
That was my fault.
It's on your neck.
That's fine, and I would gladly accept dual citizenship if you're listening, Justin.
Because I was thinking at this moment, okay, but since coming of Joe Biden, it's a different story. But earlier, maybe you could have taken asylum in Canada.
Indeed. And I'm not going to lie, I did look into dual citizenship. It's a tempting solution to think about, for example, tax on meat. And in the U.S., sin tax are very popular. So you have a tax on alcohol, a tax on tobacco, a tax on certain things that society wants to shift away from because they cause disease. Meat and beef in particular is really, really complicated. So, it's tempting to say beef is bad and let's tax it and therefore people eat less beef. But I want to unpack this a little bit. Now, beef is a singular commodity that does drive deforestation, it does drive greenhouse gases. If done in certain concentrated feedlot ways or certain ways, or you're clearing forest to make way for beef pasture. But it exists in a food system that's really complicated with many other drivers of biodiversity loss and climate change. So I would say, why not a tax on shrimp farms that clear mangroves? Why not a tax on palm oil that clears forests? Now, beef tax is it's a simple answer to a complex problem. And when I think of the food systems as a whole, I think of 7 or 8 big, deep transformations that need to happen that are not just a tax. Personally, I think a tax on beef is a great idea. The cost is too low, but I think you need to look at who depends on cheap food and how you think of it as a carbon tax, how you ensure that it's equitable. But the deep transformational changes, system-wide changes that we're not talking about, are, for example, regenerative agriculture. How do we shift from business as usual ag that puts in chemicals and fertilizers, destroys the soil health, and then, you know, ends up with a cheap commodity? We need to have a shift to organic regenerative agriculture, agroforestry. Second is shifting away from deforestation-linked commodities to ones that are completely decoupled from deforestation, growing beef, soy, palm, whatever, away from forests. Third is about the big, that tide and the current that's moving the iceberg is the subsidies for agriculture and fisheries that we're not even aware of, that we're paying already. We're already paying for beef, whether we like it or not, through our taxes. I think the fourth is avoiding waste. We waste about a third of our food in the world, and it's about, if it were compared to a country, it would be number three in terms of greenhouse gases, food waste. So how do we invest in avoiding it? I think the issue of finance for smallhold farmers, 2 billion people in the world farm for a living, and 80% of them farm on farms four acres or less. So how do we ensure that they have what they need to grow food sustainably? I think the incentives to shift diets is 100% needed, but it's also needed not just with taxes, but also with other pro incentives that induce people. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, finally, I think the issue of sustainable meat alternatives really needs to be looked at. How do we promote and accelerate meat alternatives?
I was.
Wait. Are you vegetarian, Jamie?
I am not a vegetarian. I do eat meat a couple times a month. We try to eat local, and I eat mostly chicken and fish. And you know, it's a series of choices that you have to take. Yeah.
The reason, because I was reading a report in Netherlands, because the initiative which is taking place in Netherlands. They said that the organic products in the supermarket are the most expensive. Then you have the bio product, and then you have the meat. Meat is the cheapest because this carbon emission, the water, these are not calculated. So their argument is that if the carbon emission and the water usage and the land usage prices are properly added to the meat price, then when they did again remodeling and recalculating the price, they found out that the meat was the most expensive.
Yes.
Bio was next, and organic was the cheapest.
That's exactly it. So when you think about a meat tax, it's isolating one element of the food system and then putting the burden on behavior change onto consumers. But if you were to start to incorporate the full cost on nature and climate into food, you'd see exactly that. And you'd see, we'd all be eating lentils. We'd all be eating beans and you know, barley and whatever is in your local food shed.
Exactly.
But this is also, you know, maybe it's in human nature. It's like when it's obvious for people maybe who grew up in a land, in a farm, in a farmland, you know, with in the nature, then they're much closer. It's again nature, interconnectedness with nature, then it's much obvious for them to eat naturally, locally, and so on, and not fast fooding. But the cities are growing nowadays still, you know, and people are living more and more in the cities, and they get disconnected from nature. And so meat tax, myself, I'm not a fan of imposing things, and especially with taxes. I would rather go for something like, again, educating people, educating kids, students on this healthy lifestyle, on how can they impact also not only their own bodies, but also the world around them by changing the diet.
Mm. So. Well, when I think about the rising middle-income countries and I think about China and its growing meat demand, something has to change. When I think about 2050, we're going to see an increase demand of 30% for food, 40% for energy, and 50% for water. And we're already at unsustainable levels. So something has to change. I think putting it on individual consumers can make headway, but perhaps not fast enough. Food is so intimately personal, so bound up with your family and your culture and your education, whatever, it's very hard to change. I think a carbon tax that disclosed the full impact of foods, like flying a bottle of water, you know, from Fiji to California, is insanity. I'm sorry. Or having foods that come from one part of the planet packaged in another, shipped to a third, that's insanity. So I think having the true impact of food made, disclosed, and actually included in the price, well, that could change things.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Then go ahead. I know you want to ask something. And,
I want to go back to the Paris Agreement. So it's a agreement where it was mentioned that we have to keep the global average below 2 degrees and above the pre-industrial level, and to pursue effects so that, in fact, most of the countries are heading for 1.5. EU wants to do it by 2050, China 2060. Within EU also, you have different countries with different, like Finland wants to do it by 2035. So they are very, very ambitious. But the fact remains, if you really go on the ground level, that the carbon emission and deforestation has increased worldwide really every year. This year, again, the report is that it has again crossed it. And you see what is happening to the ice in Arctic and Antarctic. Today there was a report, I think, on CNN or BBC about the Antarctic ice again breaking, the shelves breaking up very badly. So and some scientists wrote, I think, a couple of months back about a report that the damage the mankind is doing to the environment is so extensive that even the scientists themselves cannot comprehend it anymore. Mm-hmm. So extensive is the damage. So what is UNDP doing about this? You must be well aware of these reports and these things coming up. And also, there was, I think, somebody said net zero pledge grows, but ambitions fall short. So what can the businesses, citizens do, and what is UNDP doing in this?
Jamie, I'm sorry, not one question, several, many, many questions in a row.
Yeah, I'm taking some notes. Let me think a little bit. UNDP has put climate change at the very center of its strategy for the last couple of years. We have a climate promise, and we're focusing on supporting 110 plus countries on helping countries create ambitious nationally determined contributions. The NDC, or NDC, so nationally determined contributions, will be the roadmap for the next 5 years or so for countries. So that this is an investment in getting the plan right. It may seem like more pledges, but in fact, it's setting a framework or a roadmap for countries to take ambitious action. And we also work with the Green Climate Fund and with the Global Environment Facility to implement projects that help tackle climate change and also promote climate adaptation. But I think to the heart of your question or questions, you know, this idea of, how did you put it, you know, net zero pledges grow, ambitions fall short, is that it's about the nature of change. So when I was a young adult, I worked in Nepal for some 5 years. And I remember getting on a plane, and they just about when you'd reach 10,000 feet, they'd say, you may now light up. And every single person on that plane, except myself, it felt like I started smoking. And
I remember
that? Yeah. early 80s. And I don't know how many flights I was on, my carbon footprint. And then one day, you know, get on a plane and it stopped. And I thought, what happened? They said, you know, smoking is not allowed. And if you're caught smoking in the laboratory, you'll have a fine of X dollars. And I thought, wow, this flight, this captain. And then you realize it was all of an airline, and then it was all of an airline industry. And that happened within a 1 to 2 year period. And it was because of a lever point. And the lever point was when I think a bunch of stewards and stewardesses sued the airlines for lung cancer. My point here is that change occurs in nonlinear fashion, and we don't know the contours of what drives that change. We do know that Glasgow has to be a foundational year. Last year was supposed to be the super year for nature, where we had the climate summit, the biodiversity summit, and a number of, and the conference of parties for the convention. This year is turning out to be the year that's going to set the decade that will set the next century. I don't know what those tipping points are, but I do believe that they will happen. Enough pressure is on the climate conference to come out with some bold ideas. I think that my final thought is that we've all been under stress from COVID for a year and some change, but what we saw was that it's possible. We don't have to travel as much as we used to. We don't have to do certain things. We can shift our diets. And COVID has shown us not only that it's possible, but that we must do this. And so I'm hopeful for not only bold commitments in Glasgow. I'm hopeful for countries to step up. I'm hoping if countries who are interested in financing can finance nature-based solutions that have really big impacts on the future of our planet.
Can I add something?
Yeah, I also have something.
Because today, Ben, we were having this report with this professor from UCLA, and he showed this amazing graphs of how mankind's CO2 emission can go down and go up and what will be the impact of it. He said, but keep in mind that we have amazing, beautiful graphs which show all gradual, but nature does not listen to our graphs. Nature can act like this.
Yes.
Look, COVID or something. If it acts, then the changes, so he said all our graphs, all our modelings will go down the dustbin if the nature acts. So we should not think that we will plan something in 10 years and 20 years and we will cut down our emission by 2050, but nature may have different ideas about it. You can only act very fast. And then you have this catalyst changes.
It's exactly the point, you know, like when the man needed to stop smoking, the mankind can stop smoking. You know, even the transformation took 1-2 years, tack. Okay, it happens. And as I'm a non-smoker, you know, you think I would stop flying instead of going to a flight with people around. And so this is why I also like kind of questioning all this. Why can't we make such changes as SDGs? Because, I mean, we realize it's necessary. Like, why do we need this trigger? Like, what can be this trigger? Like your smoking example, that SDGs would just be implemented in 1-2 years instead of 100 or whatever years when we are still there as a human nation.
I think one challenge is understanding tipping points and one-way directional changes. We think of the Amazon, we spoke about this earlier. Right now, the average patch size is about 17 hectares. You count in all these little pieces and big pieces. It's just fragmented. By 2050, the average patch size is going to be 1 hectare. The Amazon will be gone. And why? What's happening? Well, it's little by little that you don't see, but there's a tipping point at which it begins to dry, and then suddenly the Amazon is gone within a period of 10 years. Or you think of elephant populations, or within 10 years, at current rates of poaching, elephants will be extinct in the wild. Not because it's a linear, but suddenly they're gone. The population dynamics create a tipping point. Or the Great Barrier Reef in Australia starts to shift, and then suddenly it reaches a tipping point in temperature and it's gone almost overnight. In geological times and evolutionary times, it is overnight. We as humans aren't really good at perceiving deep time. We're not good at perceiving tipping points. We think change is linear, and we don't understand the pointed sticks that move the system very well. So I think, as getting back to your question of what can academics do, it's understanding what makes people change. You know, Ben, you introduced me as a scientist, and it's true. And what I've found is that science and rational arguments don't necessarily convince people. It's the heart.
It's in America in the last mention.
it's the heart, and it's emotion, and it's passion, and it's storytelling, and it's connecting to things that people care about, their children, their jobs, the places they love deeply. And I think if there's a way to change behavior, it comes from changing the heart first.
Yeah. This is what Sir Attenborough said, I think, a couple of months back, when he said what he could not achieve in 5 or 6 decades, Greta Thunberg achieved.
And my question is, you know, how do we all become Greta Thunbergs? How do we use the platforms that we have? How do we use that little slice of operating space and magnify it to the biggest effect, so that we can have agency in the world? I don't know. I'm struggling. I'm trying, doing my best, and I know you are too.
It's. I think this is the key. You know, do what you can do. When people are doing what they can do, at least. I mean, we don't have billions to invest and give this money to project, but at least we are spreading awareness. We're teaching how to get those millions. You know, so if everyone can do with a passion what for the world, what they are good at, I think this could be already quite good enough as a step, and it provides a huge impact also around.
I see trends that give me hope. I see trends in corporations really embracing this idea of being a good corporate citizen in the broadest sense. I see deep commitments to cleaning up supply chains, like the company Mars investing $1 billion in sustainable supply chain. I see a new kind of global diplomacy with countries saying, look, we've got to get this agreement. We have to set aside the old arguments for the climate agreement. We need to start thinking about new agreements. And I see hope with the kinds of planning and discussions and new dialogues that we're seeing, whether it's a national platform on palm oil or it's the Map of Hope type of project that we're working on. It's, we need new dialogues. We need new conversations.
Yeah. Absolutely. Jamie, another question, and it goes again to climate change. This is a huge topic, of course. So in December last year, the India's environment minister mentioned that India is not responsible for climate change and is presently contributing to only 6.8% of global emissions and is the only member of G20 which is complying to Paris Agreement. We also had at our TV show, President of Mauritius, a couple of months back, and she mentioned the same, that they are one of the smallest contributors and paying one of the highest prices, whether in the sector of agriculture, to all sorts of climate-related issues. So then the term often mentioned about this is climate justice, right? So especially when countries like China are going on ever-increasing environmental destruction, and the West is economically supporting it. So what is UNDP doing for climate justice? How do you address that topic?
Because this has become quite a big argument, because I think last week or 2 weeks ago also there was a climate, where also the Indian environmental minister said the same. That why do, and I think Africa, a lot of African ministers and leaders are also saying the same. That why should we pay the most, we are the least contributor but the most damaged. So we should get some kind of support.
Yes. It's probably one of the hottest topics in the global diplomacy question of how are we going to pay for the transition that needs to happen? And the transition will cost, it will have enormous benefits to society, but it will cost. And that burden needs to fall disproportionately to those countries who've already emitted the most, who've already developed the most. And I think of companies that are saying, we are going to erase our climate impact, not only for this year and going forward, but for our entire history. That's the kind of leadership we need from countries. We need bold, aggressive investment. UNDP is supporting countries with our climate promise, and we're encouraging those countries that have the means to do so to step up and have bold commitments. But I think it's a little bit more complicated than just the idea of climate justice between countries. The first is that countries have high degree of inequality, and that degree of inequality is increasing. So in a country like India, you have a increasing inequality, and people at the lower tier are feeling the brunt most, whereas the higher tiers. And so I also think there are other elements of justice here. There's intergenerational justice about the future. It's about our children and thinking about, and there's class justice, and where are those coal plants sited, and who's having an impact. I also love to think of the idea of nature justice. It's not something that you really hear about, but how do we have the sense of, or planetary justice? So it's complicated, but I will add that the infrastructure that we invest in today, including the energy infrastructure, locks us into a trajectory that it's very hard to get out of. And I believe that countries that are committed to coal in their future will be holding on to toxic and stranded assets in the future. And no government, no corporation will want to own them in 20 years. So I would say, yes, we have to treat this as a generational and climate justice issue. I think the final piece about India, as you know, as I think 1.4 billion people, and only 5% lack energy access, unlike many other countries that have a higher proportion. But that's 66 million people who lack energy access in India. We have an enormous opportunity to shift to mini grids and to shift to renewable energy in India to show the way. And what I see emerging with countries like Costa Rica that are aiming for a zero carbon or even a carbon positive future is we need to see leadership in every country, because all hands on deck problem.
That was exactly also what the Mauritius president also mentioned, that Mauritius, the nature or the environment of Mauritius is not only for Mauritius itself, but it is for the whole world. Hmm. So it is an asset for the whole world. So if that nature is destroyed or goes is severely damaged, it's a damage for the world. So she said that, and it's this is just an example. There are also nations in Africa, in Asia. She said that's why it is the responsibility of the whole humanity or the whole world. Same like the Amazon, it's the responsibility of the whole world to take care of it and not just leave it to one country to manage it by themselves.
Well, there's another driver, if I may, another element, one of those hidden, you know, the hidden tide that's moving the iceberg one direction and you don't see it. And one of those is foreign debt. Looking at countries that have a huge, have loaned countries at, you know, semi-favorable rates. And then now with COVID and with economies collapsing, those countries can't repay. They're turning to their forests, they're turning to mining, they're turning to any way they can to repay their foreign debt. I would love to see in October at the biodiversity biodiversity conference, a commitment to transform international debt to a debt for nature swap. Because we've seen countries that have enormous amounts of debt having to liquidate their forests or turn them into gas pipelines. Why don't we use this opportunity with COVID to reset?
You're going into a wasp nest, aren't you? You need this beehive mask and everything when you go to the biodiversity.
Do we have any questions from the audience right now?
I can't access the audience at this moment.
Yeah, okay, go with another one.
Yeah. So, which one? We got the agriculture?
Yeah. So, let's continue to dig into agriculture.
Yeah, yeah, go back to the agriculture. So, a friend of ours, he is busy with this. I think he's one of the initiators of UNEP, and he's busy since more than four decades in this. And his point was that food industry is not only one of the largest CO2 emitter, but it's also, okay, this is his personal opinion, when he said meat is the biggest cause of unhealthy planet, body, and mind. And he said this is not only matter of cattle, but also vegetable oil production is the main reason of this, is one of the main reasons of destruction of the Amazon. So the question is UNDP working at educating producers, consumers, to act more sustainable and eco-friendly?
Yeah, if you think of soy, palm oil, and beef, that's somewhere north of half of all deforestation. And so just those three products alone, and they are, palm oil is in almost everything that you can find in the supermarket, anything that's packaged, just because of the miraculous nature of palm. And soy is in half the other products, and beef is, you know, an entire industry. So those three products are an enormous impact on our food, on our climate. Our food system is broken, but it works. It's this conundrum. It works because people get fed, but it's broken because in the process of feeding people, we're breaking the planet. And so we do need to shift. And when we think about business as usual agriculture, some scientists say we only have about 60 more years of productive farming left in our soils. Yeah. And so we need to rethink how we produce our food. We need to have a new model. Regenerative agriculture is emerging as something that can help our soils capture more carbon, be healthier for the planet, and provide healthier food.
Mm-hmm. No, this is completely... And are you also discussing this with the farming community or the countries?
UNDP is a convener organization. We help convene dialogues with governments, with corporations, with many. We do have the Green Growth Knowledge Platform, which helps, it's more than 100 companies, helping identify successes in meeting their commitments to deforestation-free commodities. And there are a number of companies that are committed to this. But as we've seen from some of the reports that came out in 2020, almost no company has fully achieved deforestation-free supply chains. Has achieved and been able to prove that they've achieved deforestation-free supply chains. But looking at some of the spatial data, looking at some of the technology that's coming out, I predict that within 5 years, it will be impossible to hide from deforestation-linked supply chains, just by the nature of how data is emerging and companies innovators are starting to disrupt supply chains to make them transparent.
Mm-hmm. But how do you see that? I mean, should we all plant trees now? Because I know there are people really planting trees, like getting into action here again. You know, we need to stop cutting them on one side, on the other side, we need to start planting the trees as well, because it's part of the ecosystem. And I know some of the scientists are proving that if we could grow back all the forests, we could decrease climate change effects on which is going on, you know. So again, up to action, how can we act on that?
It is the antidote to despair is to take action. And there's a wholesomeness in planting, and I fully anticipate after this interview to go out into the greenhouse and look after my vegetable starts. And you know, it's an act of growing my own food to reduce my carbon footprint. Planting a tree is the same way. But thinking about the actions that have real impact, yes, governments need to have, and corporations and private citizens need to have, a wholesale reforestation program that plants the right trees in the right places.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other actions that are really potent. And for those who are active in social media, you better bet that companies are aware of their brand, their reputation is at risk. Yes. And I read a report that says something like, if 3% of shareholders write to a company, or even 3% of the public starts to make noise, that a company will change its policy. They have to, because the perceived reputational risk is much greater than the noise being made. An individual can make a lot of noise. And I think social media and tagging companies and finding reports and waving them in front, there's a report that just came out about the top banks that are responsible for financing climate change. I won't name any names, but if you Google finance climate change banks, you'll see it right here.
Okay, I have to write it down.
Oh, I know what Ben is going to do after the show right away.
But you know, if you're considering a bank account, if you're 8 years old, you're thinking, what can I do? I have no power. Imagine an 8-year-old writing to a bank president saying, I'm interested in starting an account, and I'm wondering what your efforts are to eradicate deforestation from your portfolio. Could you please compare that with, I won't say any names, XX Bank? Think of the power that would have. And think if she were able to share it with her friends and her teachers and her parents. And think when she becomes 12 and gets a Twitter account, she's able to post. And think of what the power of social media has transformed everything. We haven't really been able to unpack that in terms of, it is the platform that allows one person to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Absolutely. I truly believe that one person can make a difference. You know, there are so many examples around the world that it's really possible. And but I have another question in my
Please.
Mind. And, yeah. It's, of course, about impact investing and how is actually United Nations itself manages own money.
That's a good question. Your pension fund.
The pension fund of UN. Yeah.
Is it SDG compliant?
Just wait. Because I've been speaking in Geneva at building bridges, teaching about impact investing. There was a person from UN and he came to me and said, you know what, it's a shame, but actually we have quite a lot of money, I will not name the number, I will not name the department, which is still not even invested sustainably, not talking about impact investing, right? So why is this happening? I know UN is a huge organization, but you are the creator of SDGs. How can't you align your investments with that? Or when are you going to do that?
Okay, now she's far from the camera because her face is getting red.
Hold on. I have a fan here somewhere. Yeah. I am so glad that you asked that question so that I didn't have to bring it up. Because in the world of pension funds, most pension funds think ethical. And ethical to them means no tobacco, no guns, no alcohol. That's the standard. Let alone, you know, SDG, let alone a deep restructuring to get out fossil fuels, to get out deforestation-linked commodities. We are launching a campaign called Green Your Wallet that we will be launching in the fall with some partners But there are already other organizations, Make Your Money Matter and a few others, that are really saying, look, we need a deep look at what is in our pension funds, because the wealth of pension funds is enormous. And here I'm looking at church pension funds. The UN is just, you know, a tiny bucket in that, but look at the church, look at universities, look at corporations that have pension funds for their employees. It's enormous and nobody is questioning it. One of the challenges is that we don't really yet have a great lens. We don't have the tools yet to take a magnifying lens and, you know, what's in my portfolio? How do I divest?
We can help you to lens it out.
I think that's the next generation, huh?
No, I would just think that it also is maybe a part of the government, because the regulations of when the mandates, when these pension funds were set up, was to have only pure return on finance.
Yes.
Impact was not really a part of the mandate of the pension funds. And I think that is where the regulatory boards or the governments should jump in.
Well, it's this idea of risk and return that's very outmoded in, it's a very outmoded idea in investment when you're not looking at the broader reward. You know, we have risk and we have return, and then we have the reward of what it does, and that has not yet filtered through the financial world, the market world. And I would include the UN fund system in that world that has not yet been transformed.
So have you written a letter to your head of your pension fund?
I did tag him on Twitter, and I did write a letter, but I have not yet. So you have spurred me on action. I will.
This is what we do sometimes as a show, you know, because we say we want to show leaders who are already acting and also challenge them to do even more. So...
You know, it's a really good point, and it's a reflection that I've had. Now, you can't see out my window, but I experienced a crisis about 12, 13 years ago when we had that deep oil spill in the ocean, or sort of spewing out oil. And I thought, I need to align my life. And I invested in solar panels. At the time, you can now shift for free. So our entire house is net zero in terms of energy, electricity use. And, you know, we retrofitted our home. We grow about a third of our own vegetables, which in, you know, where I live is a big deal. It's, for me, it's about alignment. And the issue of alignment is the most profound thing that individuals, corporations, governments can do. Align your money, your habits, your consumption, align it with the direction that we need to go. The SDGs paint a broad picture of the Sustainable Development Goals, of where we need to go. It's up to all of us to figure out, how do we adjust the levers to make them align? How do I, as an employee of the UN, align my position so that I'm ensuring that the pension fund I pay into is aligned with my values? That's the very same issue that every corporation, every individual is facing right now. And we don't see it. We don't have the tools for transparency yet.
Yeah, I think that religious institutions are facing also the same kind of situation. That a lot of their investments, a lot of their finance is not invested in projects of the, which, whose values are aligned to the values of the religion.
Yes.
So,
I think we have a question from the audience. How can we build a better world for the upcoming generations?
I think
very general question.
I think this question comes from hope, from the despair that we gave them.
Yes. I think that the beginning of a better world begins with a dream and an imagination. So I mentioned earlier, I lived in Nepal for 5 years and a very formative part of my youth. It was my early 20s. And at that time, pollution was not very high. It was a lower population by at least a third or so. I went back with my family, and Kathmandu Valley was unbreathable. It was, you know, everyone's wearing face masks. And it became the center of one of the most polluted cities on earth. And, you know, I can imagine a future for Kathmandu or for Delhi that the air is clean. Why? Because we've electrified our transportation and we stopped building cement factories in the way we do. And it's a beginning with, I'm not being as articulate as I might be. It's beginning with hope and imagination of what could be, and not accepting a status quo. What we have now will always be. And so for, I think, our younger generation, We need to help them hope and have imagination and purpose, and to give them scope to exercise those ideas and be able to be part of the transformation.
Yeah. But one thing I just wanted to get back to the earlier question is that what we had today is that they mentioned that as you raise people up from the poverty, also you see that the carbon emission goes up. So they were showing the scales. But apparently two countries managed to break out of it, United Kingdom and Finland. They somehow managed to find out a way that you can raise the economy, you can raise the growth,
yes,
but not impact the carbon. And they took both the consumer emission and the production emission. They took both in calculation and they broke it. Are you guys also in this studying this or looking into this? Because this is going to, and one of the solutions they came is that the idea of economical growth with carbon emission growth cannot continue. It has to stop. Because yeah. Otherwise, both are going to collapse anyway. The economy is going to, I mean, look at COVID. COVID wiped out 4%+ of the world GDP. The next pandemic or the next natural disaster will wipe out again a part of it. So you can't go on increasing your growth. Your economy keeps on growing without damaging it. So you have to break this kind of cycle.
It's exactly it. You know, the earlier part of this interview focused on some of the gloom and doom statistics. But the reality is, if we don't focus on fixing that, we don't have a future at all, or a future that is, you know, worth inheriting. And it reminds me of a cartoon that was popular a few years ago, and it said, what if all of this work on climate change wasn't worth it? What if all we did was restore the planet and provide clean energy and provide food to people and ensure water security? You know, what if it was all a waste? It's like, no, switching to renewable energy, switching to decarbonizing our economy, switching to sustainable food systems has such enormous benefits for people and the planet that we can't afford not to. The cost of inaction is enormous. We never factor the cost of inaction into our behavior, whether it's decisions or economic choices.
Exactly.
Well, that's, I think it's, this is my action, you know. This is what I am not tired to repeat, that we are here also to make people act by showing such example like you are, you know. But maybe you can share something with our audience which nobody knows, something personal from your career or from your current life, something what you would like to share with us.
And maybe something about UNDP, how you have made a positive impact or a difference.
One of the things that I did when I had the crisis of misalignment is that I looked at my own banking, I looked at my own investments, and for what investments that I had, which were not substantial, but what existed, I divested fully from the stock market, and I invested in land that I now lease to a solar company. I invested in a solar company. I invested in my solar panels, and that act of alignment allowed me to take action fearlessly. And so for me, this issue of alignment and fixing your finance, fixing how you get your food, how you eat it, helps in maintaining hope. I believe that hope, as I said, is a positive, it's a positive force. And so one of the projects that we run is called the Equator Initiative, equatorinitiative.org for those who are listening. And this is the single biggest pocket of hope in the entire UN, as far as I'm concerned. It showcases local action that communities and indigenous peoples are taking on nature-based solutions for the future. When we think about local communities, oftentimes people think, oh, this is cute, it's artisanal, it feels good. Instead of thinking, this is the pointy edge of systems transformation. So just one example, you think fisheries are broken. 90% of all fish are either collapsed or on their way to collapse. But in 2002, a group of people in Fiji created locally managed marine areas that were sustainable. And at the time, it's like, wow, this is cute, it's boutique. Well, that model spread across the entire Pacific. And now it's spread across the ocean. It's in Kenya and it's expanding because it's a model that is our future. So at the Equator Initiative at the UN, we've identified over 250 bright spots of change that represent the future. These are community-led change. So if anyone is interested in being inspired, www.equatorinitiative.org, and you will find 255 stories of hope, resilience, nature-based solutions for climate change.
That's amazing. Thanks for sharing that. We'll definitely go. Ben is writing everything down, documenting everything.
Have you ever seen the film Tomorrowland?
No, not yet. I'm going to write it down as an action point.
It's 8 or 10 years old film from George Clooney. It's like that you, whatever you dream for, if you dream for a beautiful world, clean nature, everything, the world will go that direction. And if you dream for a total natural disaster with everything finished, the world will go that direction. It's all choice that we all have.
I do believe that hope is an option, but it's not just an option, it's an imperative. It is not something that you feel inspired about and then you feel hope. It's that you resolve to hope, that you resolve not to be overwhelmed by the negativity of the reality around us. And I do see a lot of bright spots for hope.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. I think we have one more question from the audience. What is a missing link? Leaders, willingness, climate change, or funds? Do you get the question? Wait a second.
What is the missing link between leaders' willingness and climate change?
Yes.
Or between the funds and climate protection or climate action?
I think there are a number of missing links. I think leaders in the climate space right now are feeling the pressure. They're feeling the pressure of behind them of their citizens and their reputational risk. And they're feeling the pressure of their colleagues and peers. And they're feeling the pressure of the future. And so I think the missing link here is permission for leaders to think about the future, permission for them to make choices that may not be so popular with their, you know, that keep the future of our planet front and center.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, I think we need to, we are at the end of the time. Thank you so much, Jamie, for being with us and sharing all your thoughts, actions. It's amazing. So thanks a lot.
I had so many other questions, but then I'll have to save it for the next time.
Thank you so much, Svetlana and Ben. Really a pleasure.
Thank you. So hope to see you in person. In Switzerland or in US?
No, but you must be coming in when the UN, the September event, or you must be coming in one of the coming events or not to Switzerland?
I'm not sure yet of my schedule. It's everything is COVID normal, so we're just seeing.
So we see you online so far.
All right. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. When you want to announce next week? Maybe?
Oh, yeah. Very shortly next week, we are going to have another very old friend of ours, and he's one of the biggest, one of the oldest and biggest impact investor in Europe. So it's Stephen Brunnichmeyer. He will be the guest next week. He's the founder and principal of Willows Investment UK, and he's also the chairman of the European Climate Foundation. So thank you for that.
Yes, thanks a lot. Have a nice evening. Morning, afternoon,
exactly.
Everyone, and don't forget, act with impact.
Yeah, bye.
Welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjit. I'm Svetlana.
And I'm Ben.
In season 2, we will be traveling around the globe, out of Switzerland, and bring amazing leaders from businesses, thought leaders, political leaders, of course, investors and experts.
We're working at implementing and realizing all the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, better known as SDGs.
And they are also making profit.
Hello, I am Amina Gurifakim, and I'm the 6th President of the Republic of Mauritius.
My name is Parvati, and I'm a musical artist and the founder and CEO of Parvati Foundation.
I'm Misha Adishmichai. I'm an entrepreneur here in Bishkek. I'm running on one side a financial services company.
You know, hundreds of deals a month, we are seeing more things happening in this impact world. And this is because, look, the world is changing.
So join us to discover impact investing ecosystem.
See you every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Central European time at Swiss Impact with Benedict.
See you on Friday. Act with impact.